Eish, get bald. Well, anyway, I think we're getting off the main point here, which is that you literally tried to kill me! Oh, as though you're not going to try to kill me at some point. Is this something that happens often to you? Yeah, everybody eventually tries to kill Swamley. It's just the way people are. I really can't imagine why that is. Oh, so it's my fault people are trying to kill me? No wonder I tried to kill you. Oh, so you admit you're trying to kill me then? No, I mean, no wonder you think I tried to kill you. You just admitted you tried to kill me. I admit you think I tried to kill you, but you never tried to kill me? How should I know? How should you know if you tried to kill me? Everybody tries to kill Rabbi Swavely eventually. So what if I tried to kill a few of them back? So you admit you tried to kill me. I admit I should try to kill a few of them back who tried to kill me. And who has tried to kill you? All of my business partners.
All of your business partners?
Yeah, every one of them.
Really?
I don't know why, but eventually they all try to do it.
This didn't come up when we did due diligence about having you as an assistant.
That's because I paid them not to tell you about it.
You paid people not to tell us about your past businesses.
You wouldn't hire me if you knew. Carlop? 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 What are you doing? Why are you looking at me like that? Oh, get off. Carlop, stop walking towards me like that. Carlop, get off of me! Ah!
What a spring. Simcha wasn't talking to Ori. Mary was avoiding Bob. Bob didn't want Simcha in his house. Bethany willingly made herself the object of Simcha's spite against his family by coming over theirs. Simcha would show his contempt for the laws and customs, which were also his, by freely announcing he was leaving to visit Bethany's friends, friends he often didn't like and was sure they didn't like him. But Bethany, as always, knew how to get everybody back together. Ori knew that this tohu vavohu is what the Chabadniks take on by living in the world of Apikorsim like Bob Katz. The other Haredim keep to themselves. The Torah provides 613 commandments to keep order in life. No Jew has to lead. All they have to do is wrestle with the decisions of how to interpret laws that are already laid out to them with thousands of precedents for how each law can be studied. Blood is not red until it leaves the body, and the Rebbe wanted a thriving, bruising, lean Yiddishkeit that fights for every inch of every Jew's neshama rather than the cluttered and wheezing Yiddishkeit of Haredi sects that never ventured out into Olam Hazeh. He wanted Freilichkeit, he wanted happiness, and he knew that the greatest happiness is in letting other Yids grow into their Yiddish cups. It's horrifying for Simcha to go off the derech now of all times, but the Rebbe knows best. And if Simcha's going off the derech, it just means his Tata has to solicit and harangue him in the way he's supposed to any other Yinga Yid. It's not like Bethany didn't wear long skirts and sleeves when she was over the Freilichs, but it was not something anyone was shy about correcting. If the skirt didn't cover up everything, if she rolled up a sleeve, if she wore a color too flashy, if she starts humming to herself, Tzachi tells her, and you should cover up your hair under a shetel if you come in, after Rina gently reminds Bethany that she shouldn't be in a room alone with Simcha, which starts a roaring shouting match between the two brothers. There's that korva word again. All Tzachi has to do to win the argument is to stand a few inches away from Simcha's eyes in all his particularly unimpressive gangliness, but sans the Simcha hump. Bethany shows up again 2 nights later with a large hat. One day, Christina convinces Simcha to let her tag along. Tzachi calls her an oberkapo and tells her she shouldn't even be allowed to stay with the Katzes. Yes, it's April 1994, 5 months after the release of Schindler's List and one after it wins the Best Picture Oscar. The Oslo Accords may yet happen. The Rebbe may still live forever. A million Shoah survivors around America and Israel live out the full bloom of their resurrected lives with the Kinder and the Einiklach. They only can yearn for their brothers and schwesters could live to see trees of life grown tall and strong without roots. Gott, for was mir und nicht sei? As far as springtime in the history of our people go, this is a particularly relaxing one. So Bethany and Christina go over to Vicky's house to find some relief, and out of a mixture of pity and Christina's entreaties, they invite Simcha, who tries weed for the first time in Vicky's bedroom, only to wig out as he follows the circular logic of weed smokers, that he's too different from this crowd to even try to fit in with them, and is so completely out of his element that a wrong decision could kill him. Vicky assures him that all he needs to do is go with the flow, just lie back and relax and accept it all. But there's no way he can possibly do that until he hears, Simcha, you will relax! Accept the experience!
Christina's shriek relaxes him in a manner Vicky's laid-back entreaties never could. He lies back, resting his head on Christina's right breast as Bethany rests her head on his, Vicky on hers, Christina on Vicky's. As Simcha's paranoid mind takes in the jam rock, the prog rock, the art rock, and new wave for the first time, he experiences passive acceptance he's never known before possible. And with its 20-minute long songs whose drones serve for so many Jews a generation older than Simcha as something akin to worship, a religion substitute that was cheaper than going off to an ashram, giving them community and belonging and devotion and self-sacrifice to music too mediocre to leave unworshipped. Until today, Simcha met all things with dread, sometimes a joyous dread, but nevertheless a dread omnipresent. The dread of knowing that the world must always be engaged. The laws weren't going to interpret themselves. The books have to be read, the brachas chanted, the righteous praised, the wicked condemned. And if they don't, the world may end. The world is made from Torah, worship, deeds of loving kindness, to which Simcha never seemed particularly loving or kind. Simcha worshipped as any chassid with a decent neshama does. But where was the loving kindness which he read so much about, yet saw so seldom? His mother slaved for her children, yet so many times he'd heard her scream at him, and nearly as much at the other kinder as though she'd rather been doing anything but what she was doing. What had he ever seen from his parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts and rabbis and teachers to make him think that loving kindness was anything more than an imposition? In 2 months around Bethany, Christina, and Mary, he had seen and felt more loving kindness than in 16 years of life among Freiliks. Here are people who are not commanded to be kind, but choose to be. For the first time in his life, loving kindness seems possible. And it now feels as though the entirety of the Chabadnik community, the entirety of Haredim, the entirety of the Torah is a system whose sole purpose is to ban all love and kindness and replace it with distractions no more meaningful than a hamster on a wheel. Keep us docile, keep us unloved, keep us unredeemed. Make us believe we're seeing the world as it is when we're shown nothing but the dimmest shadows on the wall. What profit hath a man of all the labor which he taketh under the sun? And if the world ends, who cares? All that matters is love, and indeed, Simcha was very, very high.
Hey, Hillel, Verein. Is this Olam Abba?
Why is the light up and down on every side? What am I standing on?
Rabbi Swanley!
Oi, man, what's happening?
You stand accused!
Who's talking?
I am that I am, but you stand accused!
I stand accused? No, what do I stand accused of?
Do you really not know?
No, I just think if you're going to accuse me of something, you should tell me what it is I'm going to be accused of.
I think you know.
So you are that you are, but I am that I am too.
You dare the temerity to talk to me that way?
No, you're accusing me of something. I just think I got the right to know.
Ochen Bey.
Nay, Nisht Ochen Bey. If you tell me something other than Ochen Bey, maybe I can tell you if I did it, maybe I won't do it again.
You know what you've done.
I got rights. If you're going to accuse me of something, you think maybe I should have a lawyer?
I think it's fairly clear you can advocate quite well for yourself.
No, I just think if a person accuses me of something, I should have a lawyer to defend myself.
I am no person.
No, a person would realize a man desires a lawyer. What kind of guy tells a man he's accused? He doesn't tell him what, he doesn't give him a lawyer.
All right, you want a lawyer? I'll give you a lawyer.
Herbert! Oh, hey, this is Klepwasser. I don't want a lawyer.
As we said, Bethany knew how to get them all back together. She knew instantly. From the moment Purim was done, her mind was fit with a plan that simply waited for the proper moment to begin its enactment. Purim is a carnival of chaos, but the Hebrew meaning of Seder is order. Purim is about the murder of those anti-Semites who would murder us. Pesach is about freedom, deliverance, an end to oppression and tyranny. Every Purim we celebrate the cycle of violence's perpetuation. Every Passover we hold out hope that one day a deliverer will break the wheel of violence forever. Was Bethany aware of all this? Perhaps very dimly, for her thoughts are not our thoughts, and neither are her ways our ways.
The Lord declares, as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are his ways higher than our ways, and his thoughts higher than our thoughts. And yet, in the endless wisdom of his lofty distance, he determines that a few of us get a little higher in their ways and thoughts than others, and a little closer to his. And as Simcha blazed his way to the stars and thought to himself that all you need is love, Bethany thought to herself that now is time to enact the plan. Is she insane? Bob, you owe this to us all. You can't stand them either. I never said that. You said that they couldn't stand you. I never said I couldn't stand them. Look at how they're poisoning us. What are they poisoning, Bob? In 25 years, we never fought until they moved in. Are we fighting? You didn't even want to do the Purim gathering. It was Mardi Gras too. Whatever. It was for Bethany. Bethany didn't want to do it either. She wanted to do something for the Freilichs. No, she didn't. What do you mean? The Freilichs made her want to do something for them. What does that mean? They convinced her to want to do something for them. So they put her up to this. What are you talking about? They're manipulating her. Bob, that's absurd. They see the sweetest, most good-natured 15-year-old in the world, and they take advantage of her. If there's any 15-year-old in the world who knows how not to be taken, you don't know these people. Bob, don't be ridiculous. They pull you into their net, and once you're in, you can never get out. So what? So what? What's so wrong with these people? It's like they have some magic power over you girls that makes you not see what they're doing. Bob, stop this right now. No, I won't stop this. What is this madness that gripped the Goyish half of this family? It's as though the presence of conspicuous Judaism made them so afraid of being thought anti-Semitic that it blinded them to the mendacity and the injustice perpetrated right in front of them, which the Williams family has spent the entirety of American history fighting against so assiduously, so vociferously, so effectively. From George Williams of Salem, who spoke out against the witch trials in the 1690s, to the Reverend Samuel Williams, who spoke out against colonialist involvement in the French-Indian War, to the abolitionist, very Reverend Granville Williams, who turned his pulpit over to Greeley, Emerson, and Douglas in his church, and whose congregation included handsome John Brown, to Fleming Williams, who went to prison as a conscientious objector in World War I, to the sisters Margaret and Clementine Williams, who were beaten by the New York police in a march for women's suffrage, to Josiah and Augustus Williams, who went to the first convention of the Socialist Labor Party of New Jersey in 1876. Justice, not the faith which perpetrates injustice, was what motivated Williams's from time immemorial. No waiting for salvation in the world to come in their creed, but to fight and protect and serve and bear responsibility for those who suffer in this world. A Christianity of conscience, determined to make right for the sins of their fathers. And yet when it comes to Jews, the baptismal ceremony always stops at the water's edge. They can't call a spade against us because, God forbid, they occasionally get accused of racism or prejudice. Is it so wrong to be prejudiced against evil? Is it evil to tell us minorities when we're wrong? What are we, children? It's just more proof that they'd still rather not let us into the country club. It's so horrible to look at that angel every day for a third of a lifetime and know that she just wanted you because I secretly pissed her mother off. Not that in 25 years Anne's ever said anything, but look at those pursed f***ing chicken lips. There's no way she ever liked me. A quarter of a century and I'm still just a fancy pawn for the shiks of bread to make a passive-aggressive f*** you to her mother. 13 generations of Harvard students distantly related to 10 presidents, ancestors who had Emerson and Hawthorne over for tea, more sources of old money from colored labor than the world ever had room for. Whoop-de-f***ing-do, you 350 years of wasp hilarious. What the f*** has Eddie Williams ever really known about injustice? All this narishkeit about social justice and equality, it's all a goddamn act for all these Stepford people whose most stressful decision every day is which color alligator shirt to f***ing wear. None of them ever make a controversial statement without 18 years of planning how to get it exactly right and only make jokes that are too lame to laugh at.
Rebino Shel Olam, I move that my client's charges be moved for dismissal. Do you even know the charges? Stay out of this, Herbert! All right. My client is many things. He's incited many people to murder and hatred. He's been dishonest and hypocritical. His only sense of other people's feelings is to provoke them, and he is not your greatest or proudest creation.
Really, thanks to you for the defense.
But whoever thought of his feelings? Whoever thought that maybe he deserved better? You gave Rabbi Swamley life. You made him what he was. That's right. Whoever thought of my feelings?
Especially Mrs. Kleprasa.
Shut up, Herbert! All right. Kaddish Baruch Hu, Herbert Swadley is a petty, embarrassing turd upon your creation, but he has feelings, and nobody ever considered them. Objection! Mr. Gunterbund, I did not teach Rabbi Swamley every Sunday at church. I did not coach him to be Duluth High center lineman, to be anything but a nice person. He always knew that if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And your feelings should only be considered if you consider other people's feelings too.
Wait a minute. This is a trial about other people's feelings?
What kind of courtroom puts people on trial for their feelings? I called you to shut up!
What I say, just the feelings is a stupid thing to put people on trial.
Matir Asurim, I moved that my client be held in contempt and placed in a holding cell. What?
No, you're completely meshuggah. It's gonna be great. It's already a disaster. No, what are you talking about? My tata and yours won't even be in the same room. No, no Jews are in the audience. Isn't that exactly what you wanted? Yeah, but you're going to be amazing. No, well, if I'm not, it's too late now. If I can give you one bit of advice? No, what's that? Stop saying no so much. I was wondering how long it was going to take you to ask me that. I figured it was the tick. How'd you know? You never said it when we first met you. No, it's just something I do to mess around with people I like. All right, it's time. Bethany sees that Simcha's voice is trembling with nervousness, but as they've spent more time with each other, he's been much more relaxed about certain things, most particularly about the prohibition of Negiah. The principle of Shomer Negiah comes from Vayikra, or Leviticus, and Vayikra Perach Yudchet, Pasuk Vav, or Leviticus 18:6, it is written, "Any man shall not approach his close relative to uncover nakedness. I am God." 13 verses, or psukim, later, it is written in the Torah, "You shall not approach a woman in her time of unclean separation to uncover her nakedness." These prohibitions on incest and period sex have over time clearly evolved for many Orthodox Jews into the very idea that touching any woman who is not one's wife is forbidden, a prohibition which a few Orthodox Jews carry to the point of not touching their own children, parents, or even wife in non-coital situations. And yet the examples that we needn't be nearly so stringent are everywhere in the rabbinic critical tradition. It's true that the Tanaim, or Repeaters, sages from an era of 200 years spanning from the life of Christ and the Second Temple's destruction through the genocide of 580,000 Jews by Rome brought on by the Bar Kokhba rebellion to the compiling of the Mishnah at roughly 220 AD, record a somewhat more expansive prohibition of coming near or karab, any of the arayot, any of the biblically prohibited relations, be they merely adulterous or truly incestual. But the Tanaim also mention the prohibition against coming near any woman who is nida, meaning when she's in her menstruation period. If karab, or coming near, means literally approaching a woman at any point rather than a more poetic and forbidding coming near, which may even have a fully ejaculatory meaning. But even if coming near merely means approaching, then why the further prohibition on coming near any woman who is menstruating? Furthermore, the Rambam, Moses Maimonides, traditionally the greatest of all the rabbis of the Rishonim period and perhaps the greatest of all post-Talmudic rabbinical authorities, is far more liberal. What is forbidden is affectionate or lustful touching, but the perhaps unpreventable and inevitable casual touching of each other can be gone about without mental censure. Yosef Karo, composer of the Shulchan Aruch and traditionally the greatest of the Achronim, meaning the last ones, the current era of rabbinical authorities beginning around 1600, agrees with Maimonides' interpretation. The Ramban, or Nachmanides, traditionally Maimonides' only real authoritative rival during the Rishonim, takes the liberality still further and says that Negiah is not a true interpretive prohibition, but an asmachta, something based on an obviously incorrect interpretation of a biblical verse, the meaning of which is interpolated from what many see as an implied meaning. Rabbi Freilich never went so far as to stay away from his wife or children, but he would never allow himself to touch a woman not among them, and how much even less so with an attractive teenage shiksa. Simcha, on the other hand, fully aware that he can cite Nachmanides if ever he's caught by a family member, longed for the day when Bethany would touch him again. And when Simcha knocked on the door the night of Purim after the fight between their fathers and burst into tears the moment Bethany answered it, she immediately kissed his tears, held him in her arms, stroked his hair, and as his yud grew into a zion, it was a truly bittersweet half-entrance to the delights of a next world to which he knew he did not and could not belong. Could Simcha have kissed her back? He had no idea and dreaded to find out. As far as he was concerned, his father's behavior proved that any moment when he was admitted to the Company of Nations was a fleeting one. He did not belong with them, he was not among them, and never would be. But afterwards, the hugs became more frequent and even longer. Simcha did his best to go limp so that he would experience nothing but the ruach of luminous joy through which he was but a conduit, closing his eyes with the simcha, the freilichkeit, which seemed to flow through his body for the first ever time in his life. Rabbi Freilich would describe the experience as shivut ratzon. Bob Katz would describe the experience as dopamine. Bethany saw Simcha's trembling, and as she invited him into a 19-second hug, she walked him over to the back door and the porch in the yard where the Seder would happen. When they were at the open door, she turned him around and gave him a gentle nudge forward through it. And 100 UU and Quaker teenagers erupted into cheers.
Is the defense ready to proceed?
Yes, Abba Rachami.
Bring the defendants back in.
What is this defense that puts its own client in contempt? Put him back in.
Agreed.
And now we are partaking of the ceremony of Or Chatz, which means ritually washing our hands. The only difference between washing hands and ritually washing them is that I'm not using soap. People laugh. We now dip the parsley into the salt water, which we eat. It probably sounds disgusting, but don't worry, it's supposed to be. People laugh more. This now is the ceremony of Yachatz, in which we break the middle of these three matzahs into three parts, and I go hide the middle part of the middle matzah, called the Afikomen, somewhere in the house, which the children will later go looking for. The reward for finding the Afikomen is that you get to eat the Afikomen for dessert, which strikes me at least as the worst possible reward, a near explosion. Simcha enters the house to find a place to hide the Afikomen. He could have made this Seder much more like the 5 hours long Seders of his youth with various biblical interpretations of all these rituals, manifold and myriad. But who could possibly want to hear them? Look at these goyim with their smiles of vacant good vet. If they're anything like Bethany, that anxious friendliness is aching to be filled with purpose. What is friendship and goodwill if it's never tested? These people are yearning to laugh at something, anything, to have some kind of permission to be skeptical, even if it's permission to laugh at somebody rather than something. So what's the big deal if I have to play Yiddishkeit's equivalent to a minstrel or a nance? But was there any Jew in the world who needed more to laugh at it all than Bob? Simcha could see Bob's face melting in the presence of a cynicism about a subject which who knows if any shiksa ever treated with irreverence around him since a childhood, no doubt spent in the presence of women who made him seek solace in the arms of a shiksa. Permitting himself brief glances at all the shiksas as though he were looking directly at the sun, he could certainly see what Bob saw in Mary in this veritable Kinneret's worth of shiksa goddesses. Maidalas too beautiful to seem quite human, blue-eyed, pasty sirens who never blinked, who traveled in packs and never associated with anyone outside the pack with anything more than a five-word answer to a question, whose open-faced beauty seemed to radiate virtue and compassion and a desire to listen rather than talk. If such a woman deigned to show interest, what Yiddish cook wouldn't experience the slowing of time? Simcha returned, and it was time to ask the four questions. Bethany had shown him a number of books she'd found that had the four questions in them. All of the books had the usual stuff about justice and liberty and equality, drawing the usual parallels to the injustices of our time. Nothing in them was particularly interesting to him. But there was one which fascinated him, a book of four questions in 81 different languages. Simcha had an idea for when it's time for the four questions. He does exactly as Bethany instructed him 6 times and gives the book to Bob and tells him to sing out the four questions in Hebrew. Ma nishtana ha-layla hazeh. Simcha then intones it himself in Yiddish from memory. Tatech vil fregen zu dir die arba kashes. Var vos ist die von Pesach anders von alle necht von a ganzen Jahr. Alle necht von a ganzen Jahr essen mir alle Grissen. Aber die nacht von Pesach essen mir bittere Grissen. At one point, a little further, he stumbles a bit, which provokes tumultuous applause in awe of his feet. He then asks who knows Spanish and passes the book with 324 questions to Esteban Soldado, another classmate from San Francisco Friends, whose parents fled the Somoza regime in Nicaragua. ¿Qué hace diferente a esta noche de todas las demás noches? Simcha asks who knows French. The book is passed to Shannon Englander in a white dress and instantly strikes Simcha like a thunderbolt as the most beautiful woman he's ever seen. Pourquoi cette nuit se différencie-t-elle de toutes les autres nuits? Who knows Chinese? It goes to Jennifer Hahn. Who knows Hindi? Vihan Chaudhry does. Who knows Portuguese? Beatriz Gonçalves, whose father, João, came to Massachusetts to help his cousin on a fishing boat 35 years ago and was befriended by Reverend Frank Williams as a young man because he sold Reverend Frank his catch every day while the Williamses were at their vacation home in Nantucket. Who knows Bengali? Sophia Maggi. Who knows Russian? Gena Kostovetsky. Who knows Japanese? Gena's best friend, Jacob Rosenstein, who has seen Akira 100 times, and my neighbor Totoro at least 50. In 20 years, he will be nearly 300 pounds, living in his parents' basement and sending rape threats to female gamers on Twitter. German? Who could it be but Christina? It certainly wasn't going to be Alina Gwynn. Was unterscheidet diese Nacht von allen anderen Nächten? Peace finally seems so very close at hand.
Shall we try again?
I think so. All right, you tell me what I shouldn't say, so I shouldn't say it. Zokef Kufufim, my client, may be an unprepossessing manifestation upon your creation, but he is still your creation and deserves to have his feelings considered. Again with the feelings.
Rabbi, your God is telling you to shut up.
Oh, so now you're my God. At least you answered the question I had.
Proceed, Counselor.
Because somebody asked you a question, you shouldn't take so long a time to answer.
Proceed, Counselor.
And if you take this long to answer, maybe I shouldn't believe you. So why you don't show me that you're the Caddis Barkley? Your Honor, this reprehensible conduct is self-incriminating. I just think that if this voice says he's a Shem, he should show me he's a Shem.
The Creator without end does not show form.
So how are we gonna know you're a Shem? Your Honor, I move for an immediate ruling.
Petition granted. Will the defense rise?
What? You put me on trial? You not tell me for what you're accusing me? You tell me it's something about the feelings and now I gotta stand?
Rabbi Herbert Swamley is, in the opinion of this court, utterly, totally, completely unready for Olam Haba. And since the punishment of appearing in Gehanim would be too severe for the crime warranted, he is hereby ordained to go back to Earth.
Oh, so now Reb Swamley's not good enough for your place. Well, I'll tell you, mister, you're not good enough for Swamley. You think you're so great and everything's so fine up here that you can't even have some decent furniture.
What about furniture?
Chalap! Oi, wait till I tell you forever. You f***ing bastard!
Simcha has no idea what to say to all these people in the aftermath of his greatest triumph. They all congratulate him. One or two of them even say Mazel Tov, which of course comes out as Mazel Tov, and tells him how amazing it was to experience something so different. He says thank you and nods his head, not knowing what to say next to people so supportive, but glowing with possibilities unknown. They ask him all sorts of questions, real questions, about Pesach and the meaning of various customs, like the Karpas and the Four Sons and the Korech, the mixing of the bitter herb maror with the sweet applesauce charoset. And they mostly appear interested in any long explanations he can give, as only the sincerest of teenagers can be. This is the greatest and most valued simcha has ever felt in his life. One girl has particularly hung on his every word. Zara Stewart, a girl whose two inveterate pastimes at 15 were boys and psychiatrists, whose Jewish father she hadn't spoken to in 2 years, and whose mother's father moved up from Bakersfield to be the proper father she never had. When Carl Ebling himself was 15, he heard a rousing speech at the Central California Bund headquarters from Dr. Reinhard Schaffer of Pismo Beach. He was a personal guest of Dr. Schaffer, who drove every week to the Ebling homestead outside of Bakersfield to care for his youngest sister's polio without charge. Mary Ebling couldn't walk, but she lived until a bedsore killed her in 1970, and to this day, Dr. Schaffer was the greatest man he'd ever met. Dr. Schaffer told the Central California Bund that he came from a glorious country of great and humble people of the land, so much like the salt of the earth people in this room. But like regular Americans, the Germans are beset by humiliation after humiliation, and who can deny them their wrath in the face of such weakening of spirit? Germany has finally awakened to the foreign virus that lives in their midst. Madness is rare in individuals, but in groups, parties, nations, and ages, it is the rule. And it is madness to think that the world will not eventually be dispelled of this Jewish virus. Knowing is not enough. We must apply. Willing is not enough. We must do. None are more hopelessly enslaved than those who falsely believe that they are free. So America,
blessed not only with riches beyond bounty, but with such a pure Anglo-Saxon strain, is the natural partner of Germany as the liberator of the world that can make way for a new and greater form of human. To forget one's purpose is the commonest form of stupidity, though all America needs is the will to do what Germany began. Rise up, ye millions, and embrace your greatness, for whatever you do or dream, you can begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. So if Dr. Schaffer thought that Hitler was the greatest man in the world, then how could such a wonderful man ever be wrong? Toward the end, this cleanup begins, and Bethany's more distant acquaintances leave, not before each saying their goodbye to Simcha. Things are winding down, and everybody's slowly cleaning up while hanging around the living room couch and eating the matzah, which they all somehow find delicious. Christina motions for Simcha to come with her into the basement. Simcha, I just want you to know how amazing an experience it was to have known you. Known me? I am afraid I must leave in a few days. My father is dying. Oy, I'm so sorry to hear that, Christina. I hope his memory is always a blessing. It will be. Are you close to him? He is my best friend. That must be wonderful, not thinking of how tactless that might be to say at this moment. It was. He was so happy to know that I had a Jewish friend. He was? He said it was my greatest hope for my time in America. Weren't you going around with that Jewish guy for a while? That was different. With you, I feel I have experienced true Judaism. True Judaism? The thing in itself. What's that? I do not know exactly how to say it, but Tzelem Elohim. You know about Tzelem Elohim? Yeah, there were so many things I wished to talk with you about. Baruch Hashem, you have changed so much in the short time we have known each other. I suppose I have. Can you ever go back now to being like your family? I didn't want to be like my family before. You may find you want to be like them more than you know. Yeah, well, now that I've been with you all so much, I don't think I can ever be like them again. Christina bends down, stretches her long arms around Simcha's hump to cradle him in her arms. She moves in slowly but resolutely and gives him an 18-second kiss. Please forgive us. With that, Christina went upstairs and leaves Simcha as long as he needs to ponder the mysteries of what just happened. I just went downstairs thinking you and Bethany were down there and saw what happened. Did you really just kiss Simcha? You obviously saw it, yes? Oh, my God! You find that odd? Are you really such a slut that you would even kiss a thing like that? So what if I did? He's revolting! And it might be okay if he were prettier on the inside than the outside, but you know his family. You've heard what he said about us. He hates women.
You are a very dangerous person, Alina.
What?
We know many people like you at home. You will either learn the lessons we did, or people after you will learn the lessons you will teach them.
You don't have to take me to court. Oh, so I can try to kill you, but you can't try to kill me. So we're back to you admitting you tried to kill me. I didn't try to kill you. I just thought about it. Why did you think about killing me? I just thought of the podcast. What's the big deal? The big deal is that you are going to kill me so you could take it over. So I didn't kill you. Nobody killed Harlap. He's still here to kill Rabbi's family. I didn't try to kill you. No, you didn't try to kill me. You just hit me till I was asleep. You just told me you bribed people to lie to me so you could become my business partner. You wouldn't have let me on the podcast if I didn't. And what a tragedy that would have been. Yes, what a tragedy. Nobody listens to Swamley. He just wants a podcast so people can listen to him. So why didn't you make your own? It's less work to be on somebody else's. So you just decide, hey, let's sponge off his podcast? Come on, Carla. Your podcast is so great that people are going to listen. Hey, nobody likes your podcast. Maybe Swamley can do better. I really, really, really can't imagine why people don't want to be your business partner. Oh, so now you're going to hurt my feelings. Do you have any idea how out of touch with reality you are? What's reality? I just met some guy without a body claiming to be Hashem, and you're telling me I'm out of touch with reality?
You just met who?
I met Hashem.
You met Hashem?
I met Hashem.
You met Hashem?
Well, I met some guy without a body who told me it was Hashem, and he told me I was on trial for the feelings.
What feelings?
I don't know. Something about the feelings.
When did this happen?
When I was asleep.
You saw Hashem in a dream, and he told you what?
Something about the feelings.
Might it have been that you should be more considerate of other people's feelings? How should I remember? I was on trial. Have you considered that Hashem may be telling you to be more considerate of other people's feelings? Who's considerate of Svamli's feelings? Nobody cares what Svamli has to say. God is telling you to respect other people's feelings. So how do I know this voice is God? Some voice going to tell me to respect the feelings. He tells me he's Hashem, but he won't show me who he is. Hashem doesn't need to show himself to you. What? I just think you put a guy on trial. You don't tell him what? You make a ganze megillah about the feelings. And you tell Svamli he's God. He should show Svamli what he is. You don't tell God what to do. So I don't tell God what to do. He doesn't tell me what to do. You're a f***ing rabbi. Yeah, but he's not. So why should I listen to Hashem? Is he a rabbi? Did he go to yeshiva? What does this guy know from Torah? Svamli's the one with the ordination. Svamli's the one who got an adult priest. Svamli's the one who ran the synagogue. Ki yodea adoshem derech tzadikim v'derech reshaim toveh.
Copyright 2017, AS21 Media, LLC. All rights reserved. AS21 Media. What do you want your story to be?